Hello, this is Donna, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the weekend edition of the Post Standard on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. City Council okays the city budget with flat tax rate, millions for housing, from Jeremy Boyer. The first budget for Syracuse Mayor Sharon Owens took a big step forward on Friday with the Syracuse Common Council's unanimous approval of her proposed plan without major cuts to city departments. City lawmakers unanimously approved a series of budget amendments that resulted in a $350.6 million spending plan for the 2026-2027 fiscal year, which starts July 1st. Councilors made cuts and additions that resulted in a net expense reduction of $3.9 million from Owens' proposed submittal on April 8th. If Owens accepts all of the council's amendments, total general fund spending will start at about 5.3% higher from the current budget. That was a plan formed amid a heated mayoral primary campaign in which the council cut more than $16 million from the former mayor, Ben Walsh's, proposed budget. This year, the budget process was considerably more collaborative, and council put in some additional expenditures while trimming from accounts that are non-discretionary estimates at this point, such as health insurance costs and retirement contributions. Owens proposed multiple initiatives that council had cut out of Walsh's plan a year ago. This time, the council went along with the proposals, which include $500,000 to start a citywide property reevaluation aimed at fixing inequities in assessments, and $2.25 million for the city's housing strategy implementation. Councilors did want to reduce the mayor's proposed draw in city savings of $23.9 million. With the net expense reduction, the draw will be less than $20 million. Officials expect the general savings fund to be about $120 million. Councilor Corey Williams, who chairs the body's Taxation and Finance Committee, said he would have liked to reduce spending further. After diving into the mayor's proposal and holding a month's worth of committee meetings with the department heads, lawmakers realized there was not a whole lot to trim. City Auditor Alexander Marion issued a statement criticizing the council's cuts to health care and pensions as short-sighted. "These amendments are an unwise impulse for the city of Syracuse moving forward," he said. "The amendments present overly optimistic projections about health care and retirement costs that are not reflective of recent trends and upcoming pressures. Should these costs increase, it has been the recent trend, the city will be need to take an increase in what's from our reserves, a short-sighted practice that will be unsustainable in future years." Even with the cut to health insurance, the budget still projects that costs increasing by $4 million. The amended pension cost estimate would fall just below where it's projected to land for the current year. Williams said councilors chose to target reductions in these general accounts instead of department budget lines in order to provide the Owens administration flexibility in making adjustments should retirement and pension costs start to trend higher than what's budgeted. The city budget is combined with the Syracuse City School District's $640 million plan, which the Board of Education approved last month. The two plans together resulted in a flat tax rate of $28.26 per $1,000 of assessed property value. A stable tax rate does not mean every property tax bill will stay the same. The city's total tax levy will increase by $2.9 million, which will be covered by increased property assessments given this year to about 6,600 of roughly 41,000 properties in the city. Those properties with higher assessments will see bigger tax bills. Councilors also support the mayor's proposed 4% water rate increase, which equates to about $7 more a year for the typical residential customer. The rate hike will help build up the city's water fund. Owens has until May 21st to object to any of the council's amendments. If she does, the council will have 10 days to either accept her objections or vote to override them. From the city of Lysander, town residents demand more answers about data centers, from Greta Stuckey. Hundreds of Lysander residents packed a town board meeting Thursday night and spilled outdoors as the town board considered a moratorium on data centers. More than 350 people attended the hearing, but only about 150 were able to fit inside the town hall. Hundreds more waited outside, prompting a resident to ask that future meetings be moved to a larger venue. Public concern has surged in recent weeks, with roughly 2,600 residents signing a petition urging town officials to stop the projects through a moratorium. After the hearing, the town board unanimously approved a 6-month moratorium on the construction of data centers. The moratorium follows mounting opposition to proposed 300-megawatt data center tied to Ranali Super DC LLC, a company controlled by James Ranali of United Oil Supply. Throughout the hearing, residents repeatedly pressured town officials for more information, saying they do not yet fully understand what a project of this scale could mean for Lysander. One resident, who didn't give his name, asked whether town officials or outside experts would hold informational meetings over the next 6 months to explain the possible environmental, economic, and infrastructure impacts. "I want to know what the impact is to our community, the pros, the cons," the resident said. "Is it going to bring jobs? Is it going to hurt the environment?" He specifically asked whether utility companies would be involved in future discussions to explain how large data centers could affect electricity infrastructure. Town Supervisor Kevin Rose acknowledged energy use is one of the town's major concerns, and he says he and other officials would contact utility providers for more information about how a project of that scale could affect local energy infrastructure. Elliot Bristol, a Lysander resident, asked whether the town had considered making the ultimate decision on data centers a referendum, so voters, rather than electric officials alone, could directly decide the project's future. "It seems like if a referendum is legal, well, there's no pressure on the town board. People that live there, pay the taxes there, going to have to live with the consequences, should have the opportunity to vote." Town officials said Thursday's hearing was strictly focused on whether to approve the moratorium, though legal questions about broader public voting options could be explored moving forward. Bristol asked whether anyone on the board had personally visited operating data centers, spoken with officials from communities where they exist, or experienced concerns as industrial noise firsthand. "No, that is why we're enacting this moratorium," Rhodes said, explaining that officials wanted time to do that research and possibly visit a data center. From Tompkins County, world's largest cluster of ground bees was found by a lab tech seeking free parking, by Glenn Coyne. Rachel Fortas just wanted to park for free. What the Cornell University lab tech stumbled upon instead was the world's largest known cluster of ground nesting bees. Fortas's find led to the discovery of about 5.5 million bees living beneath an Ithaca cemetery. "I was completely floored when we did the calculations," entomology professor Brian Danforth told Scientific American. "The bee population beneath the East Lawn Cemetery is 3 times bigger than the previously published record," Danforth told the Post Standard. Danforth, Fordyce, and 4 other researchers published a paper on the discovery of the recent issue of the French bee journal Epidemiology. "It's possible there are bigger congregations of bees elsewhere that just haven't been discovered or reported," Danforth said. "It's not surprising that ground nesting bees would be drawn to cemeteries, especially the older ones. Both gravediggers and bees prefer loose, sandy, loamy soil. Bees tunnel underground to lay their eggs," he said. "When cemeteries were first established, you had to dig a 6-foot-deep hole with a shovel, and sandy loam is very easy digging soil. Cemeteries are also miniature nature preserves with no development, relatively little pesticide use, and a large array of flowering plants and trees to attract pollinating bees," Danforth said. "Cemeteries can be important biodiversity hotspots," he said. "The bee species found in Ithaca, named Andrina regularis, is the 3rd most important pollinator of apple trees." The discovery came to light by chance in 2022 after Fortas parked for free at a shopping center about a mile from campus. As she passed the cemetery, she spotted clouds of bees hovering near the ground. Fortas knows bees. She's a lab technician in the entomology department. She gathered some bees in a jar and brought them to the lab. "It was immediately interested because this is a bee I know is very important for apple pollination," she said. The following spring, researchers placed 10 tent-like traps around the 1.5 acres of the cemetery as the bees emerged. After 41 days, they counted the trapped bees and ran some extrapolations. Their calculations placed the population beneath the cemetery between 3 million and 8 million bees, with a best estimate of 5.5 million. That's roughly the human population of Manhattan. I was indeed surprised, Danforth said. The Ithaca cluster eclipsed the previously largest known aggregation of 1.6 million in Arizona. The Ithaca ground nesting bees, unlike honeybees, don't form complex societies. They're solitary bees, and they each have their own nest, Danforth explained. They don't make honey, they don't sting, and they're not aggressive. You can lay down in the aggregation and not get stung. They're also fairly quiet, emitting what Danforth calls a low hum. The Ithaca ground bees are typical of wild bees. 70% of all species are solitary and ground-dwelling. Most people are familiar with honeybees and bumblebees, but they're very unusual bees. Let's face it, Danforth said, they're not your typical bee. From the crime files, in Syracuse, a man killed in a shooting on Wolf Street, police said. A man died Thursday night after he was shot in the neck in Syracuse, police reported. Around 9:30 p.m., Syracuse police officers responded to the 500 block of Wolf Street after a shot spotter alert detected gunfire in the area. Officers found Tazelik Pringle, 24, outside of 512 Wolf Street, unconscious and not breathing, with a gunshot wound to his neck, according to Kieran Coffey, a Syracuse police spokesperson. Officers began performing CPR before he was taken by ambulance to University Hospital. Despite life-saving efforts, the man later died from his injuries. Police have not yet released the man's name. That's weird because they just said what his name was in the report. Okay, investigation remains active and ongoing. Anyone with information should contact the police at 315-442-5222. From Oswego County, a new superintendent was named in the Phoenix School District. Ryan Lanigan, who has 27 years of experience, succeeds interim superintendent Christopher Brine. Lanigan most recently served as the assistant superintendent for instruction at Brockport Central School District. Before holding that job, Lanigan has served as a high school principal in both Mexico and Oswego school districts, as well as an administrator in the Fulton City School District. He was selected amongst 21 applicants, and according to the news release, he will start his new job on July 1st. From Oneida County, a town of Vianna man was arrested after police said he provided false information while trying to buy a rifle at the Rome Walmart and was later found to be illegally possessing firearms in his home. Harvey Dingman, 51, was charged Wednesday after a background check denied his purchase of new firearms because of a prior disqualifying conviction, state police said in a news release. Dingman allegedly gave false information on the firearm purchase form on April 20th. Investigators determined Dingman was prohibited under New York law from possessing or purchasing firearms. Police later executed a search warrant in Dingman's Vianna home, where they said they found and seized three long guns that he was not legally allowed to have. One of the firearms was also not safely secured, troopers said. Dingman was charged with first-degree falsifying business records, attempted criminal purchase or disposal of a weapon, three counts of fourth-degree criminal possession of a weapon, first-degree failure to safely store rifles, shotguns, and firearms, report by Greta Stuckey. In business news, two former Metro mattress workers are reviving the chain, from Elizabeth Duran. The news that his longtime employer, Metro Mattress, was filing for bankruptcy protection and closing all its stores delivered a real gut punch to John Brown last fall. By then, he was already on a mission to save the stores and his colleagues' jobs. It just killed me to see all these employees lose their livelihood, especially when they didn't do anything wrong, the Baldwinsville resident said. 6 months later, Brown and James Trent, a former employee who owns a furniture and mattress store in Cleveland, Ohio, have opened 8 stores under the Metro Mattress name. So far, 30 former employees have been hired back. That's about a quarter of the 120 Metro Mattress had employed. And more will be added, Brown said. The partners expect to open a 9th store this summer and a 10th by the end of the year. The two teamed up to relaunch Metro Mattress as a startup venture. Instead of buying the stores, the inventory, and the chain's debt, the partners bought the name and intellectual property. We took a different route, Brown said. He said he saw the writing on the wall and knew the chain's days were numbered in 2023. That April, he started trying to put together investors to buy the company. Then Metro Mattress filed for bankruptcy protection in 2024, and it closed dozens of its stores in New York and New England about a year later. By then, Brown was learning the challenges of attracting investors. Most wanted a return he couldn't guarantee. "We just can't pay off that debt," Brown said. "I tried everything." Then in October of 2025, Brown got a call from Trent. He'd been vice president of sales at Metro Mattress and had heard that Brown was trying to rally a comeback, so Trent suggested they work together. Instead of investors, Brown and Trent began looking at old Metro Mattress storefronts. They worked with a couple of landlords to negotiate leases for select stores, and he had dealt with those landlords as part of his job at Metro Mattress, so negotiating new leases wasn't too difficult. "The most difficult part turned out to be acquiring the name," Brown said. "Early on, Metro wanted $250,000 for it. He offered $10,000, and that was turned down. Later, Metro wanted Brown's help clearing out the warehouse of some inventory. In exchange, he asked for the rights to the name with some cash. So then, Metro agreed, and he secured the rights for $10,000. Brown said they didn't need a lot of cash. What they needed were the lines of credit. A bedding manufacturer agreed to give them cash each time they opened a new store and stocked some of their products. And it all worked. They began opening stores under a new name, Rooms Today Mattress. They changed them after acquiring the rights to the Metro Mattress name. They started with 6 stores. Now they want to get to 10 by the end of this year. So far, the stores are in the same spots as the former Metro Mattress retail spaces. We selected the Metro stores that were good and had performed well in the past," Brown said, "and also stores that had a team of people who wanted to stay. The open stores are on John Glenn Boulevard in Geddes, Erie Boulevard East in DeWitt, and in New Hartford, Oneonta, Cortland, Horseheads, Batavia, and Webster. A 9th is set to open up in North Syracuse in June. Under Brown and Trent, the stores are focusing more on staff. Success," Brown said, "is more about the people than the property. We can have the best location in the world, but if we don't have a solid sales team in that store, it won't be successful. The workers are on board," he said. "The employees who work with us really want to participate in this resurrection. We're now a startup and we have to watch every penny and be careful." For Trent, motivation was restoring the jobs of numerous people. "It would have been a tragedy for all those people to have lost their jobs," he said. From the storefront column by Charlie Miller, Elizabeth Duran, and Kelly Corbett, a popular Central New York sourdough bakery is turning off its ovens for good. Salt City Bread has announced that it will permanently close its original bakery in Manlius before the end of the month, nearly a year after the owners shuttered their Salt City sandwich shop near Syracuse University. "With sincere gratitude, we share that we will be permanently closing the bakery before the end of the month," the business posted on social media. "Serving this community has been a privilege, and we're truly humbled by the support you've shown us." The post quickly filled with dozens of comments from customers thanking the bakery for its crusty sourdough loaves, oversized sandwiches, and weekend rituals built around waiting in line for fresh bread. Salt City Bread opened about 4 years ago in a small plaza on Casanova Road in Manlius. What started as a bakery grew into one of the area's buzziest food businesses, fueled by chewy sourdough bread, naturally fermented bagels, and hulking sandwiches wrapped in butcher paper. On the weekends, the lines regularly stretched out the door. Owners Andrea and Chris DeVita expanded in early 2025 with Salt City Sandwich, a second shop in Nottingham Plaza near Syracuse University. But that expansion lasted only a few months. "The timing wasn't right, and we physically overextended ourselves," the couple said after closing the sandwich shop. At the time, the Manlius Bakery remained open and continued serving breads and sandwiches several days a week. Last week's announcement signals the end of the original bakery as well. In the lengthy farewell message, the owners thank fellow bakers and local food businesses that had supported them along the way, including Scratch Bakehouse, Syracuse Salt Company, and several other bakeries. "A shout out and respect to the OG Central New York sourdough bakers that started this movement and paved the way for us many years ago," the post read. The DeVitas also encourage customers to continue to support local bakeries, naming favorites including Flour Dough Bread Company, Flour Dough Bread Company, FICA Baking Company, Honeycomb Bakery 315, AWA Petite 4, and Fat Cat Baking. The owners said that they hope to remain open through the end of the month so customers can stock up on their favorite breads one last time. We're looking to the future and our reinvention, the Post said. Popeyes becomes a casualty of the Cicero Chicken War. One of Onondaga County's best business fast food corridors just lost a contender in the chicken sandwich war. Popeyes Louisiana Kitchen has closed its Cicero restaurant at 7980 Brewerton Road less than 3 years after it opened in September of 2022. The restaurant, which sat within a block of Chick-fil-A, a KFC, a Dave's Hot Chicken, officially shut down April 30th. In other words, it lost the battle in the Cicero Chicken War. When the restaurant debuted, it was part of an aggressive expansion by franchisee Liberty Restaurants Holdings, which had plans to bring more than 30 Popeyes to the region. The Cicero shop marked another entry into a crowded local market built around the chain's wildly popular chicken sandwich. But fried chicken fans don't have to go far. Another Popeyes Louisiana Kitchen remains open 3 miles south at 3609 Brewerton Road. On the same street, just 10 miles south, said a sign on the closed restaurant door. So while one restaurant goes quiet, the brand hasn't left the neighborhood. It's just down the road, still in the fight. Popeyes also has restaurants on Marshall Street near the Syracuse University campus, Destiny USA, Township 5 in Camillus, and Erie Boulevard East. Is a new Trader Joe's coming to Camillus? Though there's been no official announcement, a retailer and several people connected with the town of Camillus say the popular specialty grocery store is coming to the Fairmont Shopping Center. Pablo Rojas, Ashley Furniture's area manager for the Northeast, said the Camillus store is downsizing in order to make space for Trader Joe's. Our organization gave us that information, he said. Ashley Furniture in Camillus is currently having a liquidation sale and plans to temporarily close from May 16th through the summer. The store will reopen in the fall in its current spot in the Fairmount Shopping Center, but will be smaller. Rojas says Ashley Furniture plans a major remodel of the space, and Trader Joe's would move into a space between Ashley Furniture and Marshall's. There's one other Trader Joe's store in Onondaga County, and that's on Erie Boulevard in DeWitt. It opened in 2014. A representative from Benderson Development, which leases Fairmount Plaza, appeared before the Town of Camillus Planning Board. Matthew Ost asked the board for facade and parking lot modifications because they were given the ability to take back 12,500 square feet from Ashley Furniture that's allowing them to create a new tenant space. The tenant's identity was not disclosed, said Tracy Lauer, who chairs the planning board. Because it's retail to retail, all the tenant has to do is apply for a building permit and signage when ready, she said. Is it Trader Joe's? It's probably most likely true, and people in Camillus will love it. Benderson declined comment. Nakia Road, speaking for Trader Joe's, also declined comment, saying we do not have a location confirmed. The new Salt City Coffee is now open in the town of Clay. The coffee shop at 4595 Route 31 in Clay Marketplace Shopping Center opened Monday, according to a social media post. The new cafe is now only for indoor service, the post said. The drive-thru will open in a couple of weeks. Owners Aaron and Maria Methy opened the first Salt City 9 years ago at 509 West Onondaga Street in 2017. Other cafes are inside the Salt City Market downtown at 720 University Ave near Syracuse University and at 511 East Genesee Street in Fayetteville. Salt City Coffee also is the anchor tenant in the McNeil Firehouse at the Lemoyne College campus. The Clay store is open 6 days a week until 4 and closed on Sundays. Costco's $1.50 hot dog combo is making a major change. The membership warehouse club deal, which includes a quarter-pound all-beef hot dog and 20-ounce soda, will now offer bottled water in place of the soda. The traditional combo with a 20-ounce soda and refills still remains available. This is the first time in 40 years that a change has been made to the special. The hot dog and soda combo for $1.50 was introduced in 1984 and has stayed the same ever since. Social media users recently spotted a new food court signage that reflected the change. And according to their post, the water provided a 16.9-ounce bottle of the Costco's house brand, Kirkland Signature. The addition has been met with widespread approval from members. I love that Costco is now offering the hot dog combo with water, one Instagram user wrote. A Reddit commenter noted the practical benefit, writing, "Many times I've refused the cup and spent 25 cents on the bottled water, so this is welcome." While the combo never allowed shoppers to upgrade to bottled water for extra cost, shoppers revealed that they previously bought the combo and then just paid for bottled water from the vending machine. The beverage expansion follows other recent changes. In 2025, Costco switched fountain beverages from Pepsi back to Coca-Cola, reversing a 2013 change. The company also implemented strict membership card requirements for all food court purchases, including outdoor stores. In March 2024, this came after the food courts were experiencing increased traffic, which led to members complaining about long lines and crowded seating. In manufacturing news from Rick Moriarty, Baldwinsville Brewery is set up for upgrades as AB boosts spending. Anheuser-Busch will invest $300 million in its U.S. operations this year, according to its brewery near Baldwinsville. The investments add to the $300 million the nation's largest brewer spent upgrading operations in 2025 under its Brewing Futures Initiative. The 2025 spending includes $9 million to improvements in the Baldwinsville plant. These investments will advance technology systems, support the company's workforce and supply chain through various campus upgrades, and increase production and packaging capabilities, the company said. In addition to investing in its brewing facilities, the company said it will open 15 technical skills training centers at its facilities across the U.S., including the brewery on Route 31 in Lysander. The centers will collaborate with technical trade schools to offer employees advanced training in areas such as technical fundamentals and digital tools to management systems and mechanical and electrical systems, the company said. For decades, the Baldwinsville Brewery has been a major employer in Central New York, and this announcement ensures our brewery operations will be at the cutting edge of the industry as we continue with that legacy. More than 90% of Anheuser-Busch's manufacturing workforce will receive the training over the next 5 years, the company said. They will join more than 2,700 employees who have already received it since the opening of the company's Tech Excellence Center in St. Louis in 2022. The company also said it's strengthening manufacturing career opportunities for veterans. CEO Brendan Whitworth said the $600 million investment over 2 years is part of the company's commitment to American manufacturing. "By strengthening our manufacturing operations, we're creating sustainable careers, not just jobs, and investing in the people who are vital to our success," he said in a statement. Anheuser-Busch makes some of the nation's most iconic beer brands, including Budweiser, Michelob, Busch, and Stella Artois. The Baldwinsville Brewery is the largest in New York State. The facility opened in 1976 as a Schlitz brewery. Anheuser-Busch bought it in the early 80s and, after a brief shutdown for renovations, reopened in 83. It employs 500 people, making it amongst the area's biggest employers. Anheuser-Busch said in December it was selling the brewery in Newark, New Jersey to the Goodman Group and closing breweries in Fairfield, California, Merrimack, New Hampshire, leaving the company with only 9 U.S. breweries. It said changes will enable the company to invest in the remaining operations. It operates roughly 90 other facilities across the country, including warehouses. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Post Standard on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From our Savings Angel column by Josh Elledge, "Why Summer Grocery Bills Spike and How to Control Them." Summer is supposed to feel a little easier. The weather is better, schedules loosen up, and there's more time to relax. But for many households, grocery bills climb during these months, often without a clear reason why. Between kids being home more, spontaneous gatherings, and a less structured routine, it's easy to spend more on food than you planned. The good news is it isn't inevitable. Once you understand what's driving the increase, you can get ahead of it. Let's break down why summer grocery costs tend to rise and how to keep them under control. During the school year, many families have a rhythm. Meals are planned, kids eat at school, and grocery trips are more predictable. But summer disrupts that. Kids are home all day, which usually means more snacks, more meals, and more requests for convenience foods. At the same time, people tend to shop less intentionally. Instead of planning meals for the week, it's easier to grab items here and there, and that often leads to overspending. Add in more social activities like barbecues, parties, last-minute get-togethers, and that grocery bill starts to grow quickly. You don't need a rigid meal plan in the summer, but going into the week without any plan at all is where it gets expensive. Just start with a simple outline. Think about a few dinners you can make, leftovers you can reuse, and what you need for lunches and snacks. This helps you avoid multiple trips to the store, which often lead to impulse purchases. Snacks are one of the biggest hidden costs in the summer. With kids home all day, it's easy for snack consumption to double or even triple. Instead of buying single-serve or convenience snacks, look for ways to buy larger quantities and then portion them out. Bulk items like pretzels, popcorn, fruit, yogurt go a long way when they're managed properly. And you can also set simple expectations around snack times. It doesn't have to be strict, but having some boundaries prevents constant grazing, which quickly drive up the cost. Summer could actually be a great time to save on groceries if you shop strategically. Many fruits and vegetables are in peak season and often means better prices and better quality. Build your meals around what's on sale and in season rather than sticking to the same list every week. This keeps your costs down while adding variety. Just don't overbuy. Fresh items are only a good deal if you actually use them before they go bad. Summer gatherings are one of the biggest budget traps. It's easy to overspend when hosting, especially if you feel like you need to provide everything, but you don't. Consider making your gatherings more collaborative. Ask your guests to bring a dish or a drink to pass. Most people are happy to contribute, and it significantly reduces your cost. Also, keep your menu simple. You don't need a long list of expensive items. Focus on a few staples and build around them. Buy your meat in bigger packs, choosing store brands, and plan your portions carefully to keep your cost in check. Another helpful tip is to plan around sales. If certain items are discounted that week, build your menu around those instead of shopping without a strategy. Summer also often leads to trips more frequently to the smaller grocery store. Maybe you're picking something up for dinner, grabbing snacks, or buying items for a last-minute gathering. These quick trips are where your budgets fall apart. You go in for one or two, three things, and you leave with 20. Limit how often you shop in each week, and that'll consolidate your trips and stay focused and stick to your plan. When the schedules are loose, it's easy to default to takeout or convenience foods. So having a few simple, low-cost meals ready to go can prevent that. Think of meals you can make quickly with ingredients you have in your pantry. Pasta, rice-based dishes, sandwiches, simple grilled meals can fill the gaps without extra expense. The easier you make it to cook at home, the less you're going to rely on more expensive alternatives. And with more food coming in and less structure around meals, waste can increase in the summer. So keep an eye on what you already have before going shopping again. Use your leftovers creatively and prioritize items that need to be used sooner rather than later. Throwing away food is one of the easiest ways to lose your money without realizing it. In sports news and boys lacrosse, unbeaten Cicero North Syracuse wants to join Central New York's elite, from Connor Pignatello. For a man who has sent countless records, Cicero North Syracuse boys lacrosse coach Chuck Wilbur doesn't quite have a gauge on what might be one of his most impressive feats yet, but he has a pretty good idea. After a 14-9 win over Baldwinsville on Thursday night, the North Stars are 12-0. An unblemished mark this late in the season is unheard of for a CNS program that has never won a sectional title. "I don't keep track of that," Wilbur said when asked if this is the North Stars' best start ever. "Reality is I don't know, but it probably is because CNS hasn't been very good for a long time." Wilbur, a 1995 CNS graduate, is most known for his time as the men's lacrosse coach at Onondaga Community College, where he transformed the Lasers into a dynasty. He ended his 17-year career at OCC with almost as many national championships, 11, as the total defeats, 15, before stepping away from the field that's named after him to spend more time with his young family. After 3 years as a volunteer assistant at CNS, Wilbur took the head job at his alma mater in September of 2021. The North Stars hadn't enjoyed a winning season in half a dozen years. In the 5 seasons since Wilbur took charge, they've had 4 and have already set a new high water mark for wins in Wilbur area with 12 this year. With many of his friends' sons on the program, as well as his own son Nicholas, a junior defender, Wilbur has steadily steered the young squad in one of the teams to beat New York in the Central New York Lacrosse League. From the college news, OCC seeks their first national title since 2019 from Brent Axe. Ask Onondaga Community College men's lacrosse head coach Eric Maddox about his team's chances to claim an NJCAA national title, and it's as if he speaks from a future where it's already happened. This weekend we'll say a lot when we come home with the trophy, Maddox said. That's been our goal. We talk about it, we believe it, we have faith in each other, and that's what we're going to do. That belief used to be normal at OCC, a program with 12 national titles and a 107-game winning streak under former head coach Chuck Wilbur. Maddox's vision for potential 13th title started in fall practice. I remember coming into the office and telling the coaches right then and there that I think we got an honest shot at this thing. We have the talent to do it. We have all the pieces. My expectation is to get it back to the win get us back to win a national title. The Lasers are two wins away from making Maddox's prophecy come true. Number 2 seed OCC takes on number 3 Nassau CC at 4 p.m. Saturday at Bel Air, Maryland. The winner will play for the national title Sunday at 1 p.m. against either number 1 Howard CC or number 5 seed Hartford CC. OCC, 10-2, comes into today's matchup with an 8-game winning streak in which the average was 29.6 goals per game. In other sports news, the Triple Crown is dying because it's too dangerous to attempt, from Sam Cohn of the Baltimore Sun. The purists and the traditionalists are right. The sanctity of the Triple Crown is a credit for its unparalleled difficulty. Many have tried and failed. Still, racing the second leg was historically a rite of passage for the Kentucky Derby winner. Only 13 horses have swept the three major races in the past 107 years. Only 8 trainers have chosen to forgo the Preakness, 4 of them since 2021. So consider this, the Triple Crown shouldn't be so tough that nobody even dares to try. The reason our collective consciousness gets wrapped up in the pageantry of the racing season is, like any worthwhile sports story, the cocktail of hope and mystery, we are enamored by the chase. It starts in Churchill Downs in Louisville, Kentucky, where just last week a 3-year-old colt ran what trainer Sherry DeVoe aptly described as the race of a lifetime. DeVoe's boots were still muddy when the Maryland Jockey Club invited her and Golden Temple to run in the Preakness. The chase ended really before it began, for a third time in the past 5 years. Kentucky Derby winner trainers, fairly and with the backing of modern medicine, are becoming more cautious in running their prize colts on a 2-week turnaround. Who can blame someone like DeVoe, the first female trainer to win the Derby, for arguing that her top priority is Golden Temple's health and a long-term future? Same story last year when Sovereignty trainer Bill Mott explained, "We want to do what's best for the horse." Because the sport's previous unwillingness to shuffle the calendar, the Triple Crown is on life support. Back-to-back healthy scratches underscore that truth. We're incredibly appreciative of the excitement and support surrounding the possibility of a Triple Crown win, DeVoe wrote in a statement on social media on Wednesday. We believe the best decision for her is moving forward, for him moving forward, is to give him more time following such a tremendous effort. Instead of chasing history, Golden Tempo is pointed toward running the Belmont Stakes in June. It's not just the Derby winner. Of the 18 horses that ran in Louisville, only one might arrive at the starting gates in Maryland after just 2 weeks of rest. Before 1969, the racing series experimented with intervals ranging from 28 to 42 days between the first and third races. The modern format, snug within a 35-day window, 2 weeks before the Preakness, 3 weeks before the Belmont, didn't quiet that discourse. The first year under the current model, Majestic Prince won the Kentucky Derby, then Preakness 2 weeks later. Hall of Fame trainer Johnny Logden didn't think it was in the horse's best interest to even race at Belmont. The horse's owner, Frank McMahon, pulled rank and Majestic Prince finished second and never ran again. Every trainer's and owner's worst fear for pushing a horse past its limits. According to Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Authority, race-related fatalities have steadily declined over the years, but since 2018 rose from 2024. Horse deaths, put simply, haunt the spirit of the Triple Crown. Spreading out the calendar ensures greater participation in a safer playing field. For those arguing that it would make the Triple Crown an easier achievement, the series becomes much tougher in a stacked field of well-rested elite colts. The debatement over the calendar's merits became embedded in horse racing tradition. In 2023, Racing president Aidan Butler proposed the change and did not win that battle. Near consensus amongst horse racing enthusiasts says one race per month from May to July would make the most sense. American Pharoah broke a 37-year drought by winning the Triple Crown in 2015. Then in 2018, Justify made Bod Baffert the only trainer to win the Triple Crown twice. Two horses reached the mountaintop in a four-year span, but each passing year since, the detractors of the current calendar have grown louder. It's going to happen, and this year should probably be the one to trip the scales. NBC Sports is the final year of its contract broadcasting at the Preakness. A new partner is likely to be cited this month, which opens the door to legitimate change. Before we look at things to do around the area for the next week, let's take a look at the forecast. Monday, they're expecting temperatures in the mid-50s, and that will last Tuesday and Wednesday, with temperatures climbing up into the 60s on Thursday and Friday. As far as precipitation, Monday and Tuesday should be nice, mostly sunny skies, with some scattered showers on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. More showers Wednesday than the other 2 days. Temperatures around the region in Albany, they've managed to be into the mid-50s, and in Jamestown, the same. Lake Placid only got up into the lower 50s this week, and the same was for the Utica area. Looking at temperatures around the U.S., Anchorage, 48 degrees yesterday, 51 today, and 50 tomorrow. In Dallas, though, we're jumping up into the 80s, and in Vegas, we're topping triple figures in the 100s. In Nashville, nice and pleasant in the 70s, and Seattle in the mid-60s. Around the world, Acapulco checked in the 80s, in London in the mid-60s, Paris the same, and in Tokyo in the mid-70s. In the things to do column, we're in the thick of springtime, so don't miss your chances to head out and enjoy the outdoors, from Katrina Tulloch. On Tuesday, join Crazy Daisies for a hands-on living wreath workshop, where participants will design a multi-dimensional arrangement using succulents. Each ticket includes a reusable 12-inch metal wreath, succulents, moss, and a design tutorial. Cocktails and small plates will be available to order from the Garden Cafe. Event tickets are at crazydaisyflowers.com. Crazy Daisies is at 4693 Casson Road in Syracuse. This runs from 6 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday and is $90. On Wednesday, you can join local singer-songwriters Abby Solves, Gina Hulsoppel, and Heather Claire Armstrong for an intimate round-robin performance of original music at the Pink Rock Culture Co-op. This is a great opportunity to discover new local talent and connect with Syracuse music community. It's at 201 East Jefferson Street in Syracuse, 6:30 on Wednesday, and there's a $10 to $20 suggested admission at the door. On Friday, singer-songwriter Garnett Rogers will bring his acclaimed baritone voice and cinematic songwriting for a Focus Project concert at May Memorial Unitarian Universalist Society. Known for blending emotional depth with sharp wit, Rogers performs original songs that celebrate everyday people and the small victories of life. Tickets are at focus.org, 3800 East Genesee Street in Syracuse at 8 p.m. on Friday. General admission is $25, Focus members $22. Next weekend, there'll be a battle of the wings at the Inner Harbor, will transforming into a crispy, spicy battlefield, where local bars sling their finest flats and drums for finger-licking glory. Details at syracuseinnerharbor.com. At the Inner Harbor from 4 to 10 on Friday and noon to 10 on Saturday, and it is $10 at the gate. Also on Saturday, you can invite your families to explore some of the biggest trucks from the police, fire, public works, parks, and water departments, and rigs from local companies and organizations at Big Rig Day at Burnett Park. They'll have carnival games, inflatable obstacle courses, arts and crafts, and a sensory-friendly hour from 11 to noon where the horns and sirens won't be used. 299 Coleridge Ave in Syracuse from 11 to 3 on Saturday, and it is free to get in with refreshments to purchase from Henry's House Concessions. Cornell Cooperative Extension of Onondaga County will host its annual Master Gardener Plant Sale, featuring locally grown perennials, herbs, ferns, and native plants at Emmanuel United Methodist Church, Church of the Bells. Find quality plants sourced close to home, so if you buy them, they'll grow here. Details at cceonondaga.org, 3 Kayson Road in Camillus from 9 to 11 on Saturday, and it is free to get in. The Syracuse Orchestra will bring ABBA's hits to life with a powerhouse vocalist and a full orchestra led by conductor Sean O'Loughlin at the Onondaga Krause Heinz Center. Tickets and details, syracuseorchestra.org. 421 Montgomery Street in Syracuse, 7:30 on Saturday. General admission, $50 to $98. Student with an ID, $5. And children under 18, free with an adult. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Post Standard on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In more things to do in the upcoming week, May Memorial Unitarian Universalist Society is hosting a benefit concert for displaced Palestinians in Gaza. The program features the world premiere of Steve Button's If I Must Die, a new work for soprano solo, trombone octet, and mixed chorus, adapted from Farah Sirah's setting of the late Palestinian poet Rifat Alir's widely translated poem. Syracuse-based Mossab Abu Toha, a 2025 Pulitzer Prize-winning Palestinian poet and close friend of Alir's, will participate. It is open to the public. 3800 East Genesee Street in Syracuse, 2 to 4 next Saturday. Attendees are encouraged to make a tax-deductible donation in person, online, or by mail. Open Up Downtown offers participants the chance to explore iconic buildings in downtown Syracuse, including behind-the-scenes access to spaces not typically open to the public. Tour stops will include the Niagara Mohawk Building, State Tower Roof Deck, City Hall, Mizpah Tower, Landmark Theater Lobby, and more, with historical and architectural insights provided along the way. Tickets at tinyurl.com/openupdowntown. Various spots will be in the downtown Syracuse area starting from 10 to 3 on Saturday. Presale tickets are $15, the day of are $20, and parking is free on downtown Syracuse streets the day of the event. CNY Folks March invites walkers to explore the scenic paths at Chittenango Falls State Park, including a moderate steep gorge trail leading to the base of the falls and five more trails leading along the top. At the May 17 walk, Elizabeth Belfour from the CNY Lyme and Tick-Borne Disease Alliance will talk about tick safety and distribute a limited amount of tick kits. Dogs on leashes are welcome. 5241 Gorge Route, State Route 13 in Casanova. Register from 9 to noon on Saturday and 1 to 3 on May 17th. Adults are $4, veterans $2, children 5 to 18 $1, and a family maximum charge is $9. RetroGameCon will be at the On Center with video games and artists, crafts, vendors, free play video games, panel presentations, tournaments, and special guests. The show offers something for gamers of all ages, from children 7 and under admitted free with a paid adult. 800 State Street in Syracuse from 10 to 6 on Saturday and 10 to 4 on Sunday the 17th. Adults on Saturday are $21.60. On Sunday, $12.96, but a two-day pass you can get in for $32.40. Kids 7 and under are free, limited 2 per paid adult, or a Sunday family pack is $43.20. The Baldwinsville Harriers Booster Club hosts a pancake breakfast fundraiser at the Home Team Pub in Liverpool next weekend to support the cross-country track and field programs, which serve more than 600 athletes from modified to varsity level. Proceeds go toward equipment, travel expenses, scholarships, and other items. Tickets are at tinyurl.com/Baldwinsville Pancake and at the door. 7990 Oswego Road in Liverpool from 9 to 11 on Sunday the 17th. It's $15, but four more tickets, you get 10% off. The Mycroft Home Society will meet at Community Library of Jamesville in DeWitt for a presentation by Linda Anderson on unsubstantiated differences on Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and his writings about Sherlock Holmes. Bring items for show and tell. All friends of Sherlock Holmes are welcome. Jamesville Road in Jamesville at 1:30 on May 17th, and it is free. Attendees are asked to bring a small snack to share and their own non-alcoholic beverages. And finally, the Syracuse Youth Orchestra will hold a concert at Solvay High School featuring Gershwin's An American in Paris, Borden Symphony No. 2, and Haydn Symphony 39 movements. Tickets and details at syracuseorchestra.org. 600 Gertrude Ave in Solvay, 3 p.m. on May 17th. General admission is $20, seniors $18, college students with an ID $5, and children under 18 accompanied by adult are free. As you increase traveling around the summer hours, here's some tips from the Tribune News Service about keeping your dog from getting car sick. Car sick isn't just a phenomenon the humans experience. In fact, car sickness in dogs is a common condition. The AKC provides tips on how to predict, relieve, and control your dog's car sickness. Just like humans, motion sickness in dogs is related to a sense of balance due to the structure of the inner ear. Sometimes they never outgrow the nausea and vomiting caused by car sickness. Dogs also suffer from anxiety. They can associate the car with unpleasant or traumatic things like trips to the vet or being separated from their litter. If your dog's first few car trips resulted in being car sick and vomiting, they can associate the car itself with being sick. Regardless of the cause, there are things you can do to ease the physical and psychological symptoms. Make the ride comfortable. Adjust what your dog sees. Put your dog in the middle seat in the back so they're more likely to look forward instead of watching things out the side window. Lower the car window. Even a little fresh air equalizes internal and external air pressure around their ears, which reduces nausea. Keep the car cool and well ventilated. Restrict their food intake if possible, withhold food for 12 hours before the trip, but make sure not to restrict their access to water. Bring something your dog likes from home so that comfortable smell helps them be less anxious. You can take steps to help your dog overcome motion sickness and car anxiety by putting your pup in the car with you a few minutes a day. Slowly increase the progression of exposure by turning on the car and increasing the length of time in the car. Go at your dog's pace and keep your cool. Medication for the car sickness is available. There are also physical remedies such as medication and herbs and plants that can help your dog settle their stomach, such as lavender, ginger, and valerian. But be sure to consult your vet before giving your dog any meds or herbal remedies. Being part of a responsible dog owner is prioritizing, say that three times fast, even when you're away on vacation or at work. Here's a checklist for dog owners to keep in mind when setting up a dog sitter. Maintain a routine. Keep your dog on their usual schedule when they're gone and give your sitter a detailed breakdown of their daily routine. That includes meals and walks. This makes the transition easier and prevents accidents. Consistency is the key when enforcing house rules for your dog. Make sure your sitter knows what they are and isn't allowed to break them. If your dog has any medical conditions, allergies, and medications, make sure your dog knows those details. Leave your emergency info for them in case they need to reach you. And prepare your home if you're going to be gone for a long time, making sure there's enough food, doggy bags, and supplies stocked and ready for the dog sitter, especially in case your return gets delayed. Make sure any cleaning products, hazardous things are safely stored out of the dog's reach, and repair any gaps in your fence and secure all the gates so the sitter doesn't have to worry about that as well. In entertainment news, Netflix's Lord of the Flies is a harrowing descent into horror, and the cast had a ball, from Mark Kennedy of the Associated Press. Put 40 boys together alone on an island, and what do you get? Harmony or chaos? British author William Golding predicted not good things in his harrowing 1954 classic novel, Lord of the Flies, and a new powerful kinetic TV adaptation makes an inspired case that he probably was right. The Netflix series follows more than two dozen British boys in the mid-50s that are stranded on a tropical island after a plane crash, and they descend into tyranny and violence, making an indictment about the fragility of democracy and the shallow veneer of civilization. The series is adapted by Jack Thorne, the writer behind the stage play Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, and the Emmy-winning series Adolescence, and directed by his longtime collaborator Mark Mundin. A lot of the time it was utter chaos, and we tried to film some of that chaos as well, says Mundin. It can't help be chaos when you've got 36 boys under the age of 12. What began as a plucky "we're all in this together" spirit, Piggy sings Groucho Marx's "Hello, I Must Be Going" as he pushes through thick vegetation, still wearing his schoolboy suspenders and tie, gets darker as envy and paranoia bloom, rivalries deepen, and one of the boys reveals his murderous tendencies. You can delve as far as you like into the drama and the horror of it, because you know at the end of the day, you're just going to get into a van, go back to the hotel, and jump into the pool, said the actors. The ending actually has a sweetness. Not the adaptation, but the filming. It turns out many of the older boys have stayed friends and share group chats. Sawyer's just met up with Pratt, enemies on the island that now remain pals in real life. From What to Stream column, John Bernthal reprises his role as Marvel anti-hero The Punisher, One Last Kill. In television, U.S. Against the World, 4 years with the men's national soccer team, a five-part docuseries that is going to air weekly, spends 4 years following the U.S. men's national soccer team as the squad prepares for this year's World Cup. It starts Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on HBO. Everyone is Doing Great. It's a coming-of-age comedy about two former TV stars, James Lafferty and Stephen Colletti, which debuted on Hulu more than 5 years ago and now comes to Netflix for its previously filmed but never aired second season. That will begin streaming Monday on Netflix. The Untold UK, a sports docuseries, gets a British spinoff with documentaries about James Vardy, Liverpool's Miracle of Istanbul, and Vinnie Jones. Those will all begin streaming on Tuesdays on Netflix. Good Omens, a delayed and severely shortened just to a 90-minute episode after its creator Neil Gaiman landed in hot water. The third season of the David Tennant and Michael Sheen-led fantasy series begins streaming Wednesday on Prime Video. Off Campus, is there enough room on TV for a second steamy hockey romance? Adapted from a book series by Ella Kennedy, Off Campus follows the members of an elite college hockey team and the women who love them. That begins streaming Wednesday on Prime Video. Nemesis, with Matthew Law, Yolande Noel, Cleopatra Coleman, Trey Hale, and Dominic Lombardozzi, star in a cat-and-mouse heist drama from the creator of Power. That begins streaming Thursday on Netflix. Dutton Ranch, the fourth new Taylor Sheridan-produced series to arrive in the first half of this year, Dutton Ranch is another spinoff from Yellowstone. It finds Kelly Riley and Cole Hauser reprising their roles as Beth Dutton and Rip Wheeler, respectively. Now they are in South Texas, where they do battle with a ruthless rival rancher, Ed Harris, Annette Bening, Hi Courtly, Finn Little, Juan Pablo Raba, and J.R. Villarreal also will star. That will begin streaming next Friday on Paramount. In home video and on demand, Wuthering Heights is available from filmmaker Emeril Fennell's loose take on the Emily Bronte 1847 novel is a tempestuous, salacious love story set in the Yorkshire Moors, starring Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi. And the Pusher trilogy with Nicholas Winding, Ralph's cult classic films, have now been restored in 4K. And to wrap up this weekend's readings, we have a commentary from someone about Mother's Day. This is a special to the Post Standard from Tina Trumbull, titled This Mother's Day, My Grief Has a New Purpose, Helping Others Find Hope. As Mother's Day is upon us, I look at how differently I celebrate now. A holiday that once held a messy breakfast in bed, made with love by my kids, smiling through chewing the scrambled eggs that had some eggshells mixed in, taking flowers to my mother's house and weeding her flower beds. This year, I'll be celebrating by visiting my daughter's memorial bench and watching the sunset at Sterling Nature Center. The summer of 2024 changed my role as a mother forever, losing both of my daughters in a tragic car accident and then my own mother to cancer just 5 weeks later. I was honored to be their mother. I love them their entire lives and will miss them for the rest of mine. I watched them grow into vibrant and outgoing young women. I was also blessed to have been able to care for my mother in her final days. I went from raising kids to being a caregiver to my elderly mother, only to have it all taken away in a few short weeks. I struggled to find purpose in life again. Waking up in an empty house with no one to care for was foreign to me. As part of my healing journey, I began traveling, taking my daughter's ashes to places they had wanted to visit. My girls were adventurous and ambitious, and I hope to complete as many of their bucket list trips as I possibly can. As I push myself to the top of mountains, cross the sky bridge in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, with frazzled nerves, and got lost in the crowds of big cities, I began to experience chance encounters with other grieving people. It seemed like we recognized an unspoken bond within each other. The more people I met, the more I began to realize the lack of support for people who struggle with grief. Slowly, I began to realize a new purpose. I began writing in my recently published book, Everything Beautiful, that chronicles my memorial travels, with the proceeds funding a scholarship named for my daughters. You've been listening to an Articles and Features from the weekend edition of the Post Standard. Your reader has been Donna, and thank you for listening.